The Poacher. From Sylvia Townsend Warner. And must one kiss revoke the silent house, the birdsong wilderness? I was a child when I came to the great hedge for the first time. I was hunting mushrooms, not for sport, as I have read ladies and gentlemen do, but in earnest. To hunt without need is the privilege, they say, of noblemen. I should say that it is one of the acts that makes a man a nobleman, that constitutes privilege itself. To hunt because one is hungry is the lot of the commoner. All it generally makes of him is a poacher. I was poaching mushrooms then in the king's forest. My father had sent me out that morning with a basket and the command, "Don't come sneaking back here till it's full." I knew he would beat me if I didn't come back with the basket full of something to eat. Mushrooms at best at this time of year, or the fiddleheads of ferns that were just beginning to poke through the cold ground in a few places. He would hit me across the shoulders with the hoe handle or a switch and send me to bed supperless because he was hungry and disappointed. He could feel that he was at least better off than somebody if he made me hungrier than himself and sore and ashamed as well. After a while, my stepmother would pass silently by my corner of the hut and leave on my pallet or in my hand some scrap she had contrived or saved from her own scant supper. Half a crust, a lump of peas pudding. Her eyes told me eloquently, "Don't say anything," and I said nothing. I never thanked her. I ate the food in darkness. Often my father would beat her. It was my fate, fortunate or misfortunate, not to feel better off than her when I saw her beaten. Instead, I felt more ashamed than ever, worse off even than the weeping, wretched woman. She could do nothing, and I could do nothing for her. Once I tried to sweep out the hut when she was working in our field, so that things would be in order when she came back, but my sweeping only stirred the dirt around. When she came in from hoeing, filthy and weary, she noticed nothing, but set straight to building up the fire, fetching water, and so on, while my father, as filthy and weary as she, sat down in the one chair we had with a great sigh. And I was angry because I had, after all, done nothing at all. I remembered that when my father first married her, when I was quite small, she had played with me like another child. She knew knife-toss games and taught me them. She taught me the ABC from a book she had. The nuns had brought her up, and she knew her letters, poor thing. My father had a notion that I might be led into the friary if I learned to read and make the family rich. That came to nothing, of course. She was little and weak and not the help to him at work my mother had been, and things didn't prosper for us. My lessons in reading ended soon. It was she who found I was a clever hunter and taught me what to look for. The golden and brown mushrooms, woodmasters and morels and other fungi. The wild shoots, roots, berries, and hips in their seasons. The cresses in the streams. She taught me to make fish traps. My father showed me how to set snares for rabbits. They soon came to count on me for a good portion of our food, for everything we grew in our field went to the baron who owned it, and we were allowed to cultivate only a mere patch of kitchen garden, lest our labors there detract from our work for the baron. I took pride in my foraging, and went willingly into the forest and fearlessly. Did we not live on the very edge of the forest, almost in it? Did I not know every path and glade and grove within a mile of our hut? I thought of it as my own domain. But my father still ordered me to go every morning as if I needed his command, and he laced it with distrust. "Don't come sneaking back until the basket's full." That was no easy matter sometimes, in early spring when nothing was up yet, like the day I first saw the great hedge. Old snow still lay grayish in the shadows of the oaks. I went on, finding not a mushroom nor a fiddlehead. Mummied berries hung on the branches, tasting of decay. There had been no fish in the trap, no rabbit in the snares, and the crayfish were still hiding in the mud. I went on farther than I had yet gone, hoping to discover a new fern break or trace a squirrel's nut hoard by her tracks on the glazed and porous snow. I was trudging along easily enough, having found a path almost as good as a road, like the avenue that led to the Baron's Hall. Cold sunlight lay between the tall beech trees that stood along it. At the end of it was something like a hedgerow, but high, so high I had taken it at first for clouds. Was it the end of the forest? The end of the world? I stared as I walked, but never stopped walking. The nearer I came, the more amazing it was, a hedge taller than the ancient beeches and stretching as far as I could see to left and right. Like any hedgerow, it was made of shrubs and trees that had laced and wove themselves together as they grew, but they were immensely tall and thick and thorny. At this time of the year, the branches were black and bare, but nowhere could I find the least gap or hole to let me peer through to the other side. From the huge roots up, the thorns were impenetrably tangled. I pressed my face up close and got well scratched for my pains, but saw nothing but an endless dark tangle of gnarled stems and fierce branches. Well, I thought, if they're brambles, at least I've found a lot of berries come summer. For I didn't think about much but food when I was a child. It was my whole business and chief interest. All the same, a child's mind will wander. Sometimes when I'd had enough to eat for supper, I'd lie watching our tiny hearth fire dying down and wonder what was on the other side of the great hedge of thorns. The hedge was indeed a treasury of berries and haws, so that I was often there all summer and autumn. It took me half the morning to get there, but when the great hedge was bearing, I could fill my basket and sack with berries or haws in no time at all, and then I had all the middle of the day to spend as I pleased, alone. Oftenest, what pleased me was to wander along beside the hedge, eating a particularly fine blackberry here and there, dreaming formless dreams. I knew no tales then, except the terribly simple one of my father, my stepmother, and myself, and so my daydreams had no shape or story to them. But all the time I walked, I had half an eye for any kind of gap or opening that might be a way through the hedge. If I had a story to tell myself, that was it. There was a way through the great hedge, and I'd discover it. Climbing it was out of the question. It was the tallest thing I had ever seen, and up all that great height the thorns of the branches were as long as my fingers and sharp as sewing needles. If I was careless picking berries from it, my clothes got caught and ripped, and my arms were a net of red and black scratches every summer. Yet I liked to go there and to walk beside it. One day of early summer, some years after I first found the hedge, I went there. It was too soon for berries, but when the thorns blossomed, the flowered sprays rose up and up, one above the other, like clouds into the sky. And I liked to see that, and to smell their scent, as heavy as the smell of meat or bread, but sweet. I set off to the right. The walking was easy all along the hedge, as if there might have been a road there once. The sun-dappling arms of the old beeches of the forest didn't quite reach to the thorny wall that bore its highest sprays of blossom high above their crowns. It was shady under the wall, smelling heavily of blackberry flowers, and windlessly hot. It was always very silent there, a silence that came through the hedge. I had noticed long ago that I never heard a bird sing on the other side, though their spring songs might be ringing down every aisle of the forest. Sometimes I saw birds fly over the hedge, but I never was sure I saw the same one fly back. So I wandered on in the silence, on the springy grass, keeping an eye out for the little russet brown mushrooms that were my favorites, when I began to feel something queer about the grass and the woods and the flowering hedge. I thought I had never walked this far before, and yet it all looked as if I had seen it many times. Surely I knew that clump of young birches, one bent down by last winter's long snow. Then I saw, not far from the birches, under a currant bush behind the grassy way, a basket and a knotted sack. Someone else was here, where I had never met another soul. Someone was poaching in my domain. People in the village feared the forest. Because our hut was almost under the trees of the forest, people feared us. I never understood what they were afraid of. They talked about wolves. I had seen a wolf's track once, and sometimes heard the lonely voices winter nights, but no wolf came near the houses or fields. People talked about bears. Nobody in our village had ever seen a bear or a bear's track. People talked about dangers in the forest, perils and enchantments, and rolled their eyes and whispered, and I thought them all great fools. I knew nothing of enchantments. I went to and fro in the forest and up and down in it as if it were my kitchen garden, and never yet had I found anything to fear. So whenever I had to go the half mile from our hut and enter the village, people looked askance at me and called me the wild boy. And I took pride in being called wild. I might have been happier if they had smiled at me and called me by my name. But as it was, I had my pride, my domain, my wilderness, where no one but I dared go. So it was with fear and pain that I gazed at the signs of an intruder, an interloper, a rival, until I recognized the bag and basket as my own. I had walked right round the great hedge. It was a circle. My forest was all outside it. The other side of it was, whatever it was, inside. From that afternoon, my lazy curiosity about the great hedge grew to a desire and resolve to penetrate it and see for myself that hidden place within, that secret. Lying watching the dying embers at night, I thought now about the tools I would need to cut through the hedge and how I could get such tools. The poor little hoes and mattocks we worked our field with would scarcely scratch those great stems and branches. I needed a real blade and a good stone to whet it on. So began my career as a thief. An old woodcutter down in the village died. I heard of his death at market that day. I knew he had lived alone and was called a miser. He might have what I needed. That night when my father and stepmother slept, I crept out of the hut and went back by moonlight to the village. The door of the cottage was open. A fire smoldered in the hearth under the smoke hole. In the sleeping end of the house, to the left of the fire, a couple of women had laid out the corpse. They were sitting up by it, chatting, now and then putting up a howl or two of keening when they thought about it. I went softly into the stall end of the cottage. The fire was between us, and they didn't see or hear me. The cow chewed her cud. The cat watched me. The women across the fire mumbled and laughed, and the old man lay stark on his pallet in his winding sheet. I looked through his tools quietly, but without hurrying. He had a fine hatchet, a crude saw, and a mounted circular grindstone, a treasure to me. I couldn't take the mounting, but stuck the handle in my shirt, took the tools under my arm and the stone in both hands, and walked out again. "Who's there?" said one of the women, without interest, and set up a perfunctory wail. The stone all but pulled my arms out before I got it up the road to our hut, where I hid it and the tools and the handle a little way inside the forest under a bit of brushwood. I crept back into the windowless blackness of the hut, and felt my way over to my pallet, for the fire was dead. I lay a long time, my heart beating hard, telling my story. I had stolen my weapons. Now I would lay my siege on the great thorn hedge. But I didn't use those words. I knew nothing of sieges, wars, victories, all such matters of great history. I knew no story but my own. It would be a very dull one to read in a book. I can't tell much of it. All that summer and autumn, winter and spring, and the next summer and the next autumn and the next winter, I fought my war. I laid my siege. I chopped and hewed and hacked at the thicket of bramble and thorn. I cut through a thick, tough trunk, but couldn't pull it free till I had cut through 50 branches tangled in its branches. When it was free, I dragged it out, and then began to cut at the next thick trunk. My hatchet grew dull 1,000 times. I had made a mount for the grindstone, and on it I sharpened the hatchet 1,000 times, till the blade was worn down into the thickness of the metal and would not hold an edge. In the first winter, the saw shivered against a rootstock hard as flint. In the second summer, I stole an axe and a handsaw from a party of traveling woodcutters camped a little way inside the forest, near the road to the Baron's Hall. They were poaching wood from my domain, the forest. In return, I poached tools from them. I felt it was a fair trade. My father grumbled at my long absences, but I kept up my foraging and had so many snares out that we had rabbit as often as we wanted it. In any case, he no longer dared strike me. I was 16 or 17 years old, I suppose, and though I was by no means well-grown or tall or very strong, I was stronger than he, a worn-out old man 40 years old or more. He struck my stepmother as often as he liked. She was a little, toothless, red-eyed old woman now. She spoke very seldom. When she spoke, my father would cuff her, railing at women's chatter, women's nagging. "Will you never be quiet?" he would shout, and she would shrink away, drawing her head down in her hunched shoulders like a turtle. And yet sometimes when she washed herself at night, with a rag and a basin of water warmed in the ashes, her blanket would slip down, and I saw her body was fine-skinned, with soft breasts and rounded hips, shadowy in the firelight. I would turn away, for she was frightened and ashamed when she saw me looking at her. She called me son, though I was not her son. Long ago she had called me by my name. Once I saw her watching me as I ate. It had been a good harvest that first autumn, and we had turnips right through the winter. She watched me with a look on her face, and I knew she wanted to ask me then, while my father was out of the house, what it was I did all day in the forest, why my shirt and vest and trousers were forever ripped and shredded, why my hands were calloused on the palms and cross-hatched with 1,000 scratches on the backs. If she had asked, I would have told her. But she didn't ask. She turned her face down into the shadows, silent. Shadows and silence filled the passage I had hacked into the great hedge. The thorn trees stood so tall and thickly branched above it that no light at all made its way down through them. As the first year came round, I had hacked and sawn and chopped a passage of about my height and twice my length into the hedge. It was as impenetrable as ever before me, not allowing a glimpse of what might be on the other side, nor a hint that the tangle of branches might be any thinner. Many a time at night I lay hearing my father snore, and said to myself that when I was an old man like him, I would cut through the last branch and come out into the forest, having spent my life tunneling through nothing but a great round bramble patch, with nothing inside it but itself. I told that end to my story, but I didn't believe it. I tried to tell other ends. I said, I will find a green lawn inside the hedge, a village, a friary, a hall, a stony field. I knew nothing else that one might find. But these endings didn't hold my mind for long. Soon I was thinking again of how I should cut the next thick trunk that stood in my way. My story was the story of cutting a way through an endless thicket of thorny branches and nothing more. And to tell it would take as long as it took to do it. On a day near the end of winter, such a day as makes it seem there will be no end to winter, a chill, damp, dark, dreary, hungry day, I was sawing away with the woodcutter's saw at a gnarled, knotted white thorn as thick as my thigh and hard as iron. I crouched in the small space I had and sawed away with nothing in my mind but sawing. The hedge grew unnaturally fast in season and out. Even in midwinter, thick, pale shoots would grow across my passageway, and in summer I had to spend some time every day clearing out new growth, thorny green sprays full of stinging sap. My passage or tunnel was now more than 5 yards long, but only 1.5 feet high except at the very end. I had learned to wriggle in and keep the passage man-high only at the end, where I must have room enough to get a purchase on my axe or saw. I crouched at my work, glad to give up the comfort of standing for a gain in going forward. The white-thorn trunk split suddenly, in the contrary evil way the trees of that thicket had. It sent the saw blade almost across my thigh, and as the tree fell against the others interlaced with it, a long branch whipped across my face. Thorns raked my eyelids and forehead. Blinded with blood, I thought it had struck my eyes. I knelt, wiping away the blood with hands that trembled from strain and the suddenness of the accident. I got one eye clear at last, and then the other, and blinking and peering, saw light before me. The white thorn in falling had left a gap, and in the maze and crisscross of dark branches beyond it was a small, clear space, through which one could see as through a chink in a wall. And in that small, bright space, I saw the castle. I know now what to call it. What I saw then I had no name for. I saw sunlight on a yellow stone wall. Looking closer, I saw a door in the wall. Beside the door stood figures, men perhaps, in shadow, unmoving. After a time I thought they were figures carved in stone, such as I had seen at the doors of the Friary Church. I could see nothing else. Sunlight, bright stone, the door, the shadowy figures. Everywhere else the branches and trunks and dead leaves of the hedge massed before me as they had for 2 years, impenetrably dark. I thought if I was a snake, I could crawl through that hole. But being no snake, I set to work to enlarge it. My hands still shook, but I took the axe and struck at the mast and crossing branches. Now I knew which branch to cut, which stem to chop, whichever lay between my eyes and that golden wall, that door. I cared nothing for the height or width of my passage, so long as I could force and tear my way forward, indifferent to the lacerations of my arms and face and clothing. I swung my dull axe with such violence that the branches flew before me, and as I pushed forward, the branches and stems of the hedge grew thinner, weaker. Light shone through them. From winter blackened hard, they became green and soft as I hacked and forced on forward until I could put them aside with my hand. I parted the last screen and crawled on hands and knees out onto a lawn of bright grass. Overhead, the sky was the soft blue of early summer. Before me, a little downhill from the hedge, stood the house of yellow stone, the castle in its moat. Flags hung motionless from its pointed towers. The air was still and warm. Nothing moved. I crouched there, as motionless as everything else, except for my breath, which came loud and hard for a long time. Beside my sweaty, blood-streaked hand, a little bee sat on a clover blossom, not stirring, honey drunk. I raised myself to my knees and looked all around me, cautious. I knew that this must be a hall, like the Baron's Hall above the village, and therefore dangerous to anyone who did not live there or have work there. It was much larger and finer than the Baron's Hall, and infinitely fairer. Larger and fairer even than the Friary Church. With its yellow walls and red roofs, it looked, I thought, like a flower. I hadn't seen much else I could compare it to. The Baron's Hall was a squat keep with a scumble of huts and barns about it. The church was gray and grim, the carved figures by its door faceless with age. This house, whatever it was delicate and fine and fresh. The sunlight on it made me think of the firelight on my stepmother's breasts. Halfway down the wide grassy slope to the moat, a few cows lay in midday torpor, heads up, eyes closed. They weren't even chewing the cud. On the farther slope, a flock of sheep lay scattered out, and an apple orchard was just losing its last blossoms. The air was very warm. In my torn, ragged shirt and coat, I would have been shivering as the sweat cooled on me on the other side of the hedge where winter was. Here I shrugged off the coat. The blood from all my scratches, drying, made my skin draw and itch, so that I began to look with longing at the water in the moat. Blue and glassy it lay, very tempting. I was thirsty, too. My water bottle lay back in the passage, nearly empty. I thought of it, but never turned my head to look back. No one had moved on the lawns or in the gardens around the house, or on the bridge across the moat, all the time I had been kneeling here in the shadow of the great hedge gazing my fill. The cows lay like stones, though now and again I saw a brown flank shudder off a fly, or the very tip of a tail twitch lazily. When I looked down, I saw the little bee still on the clover blossom. I touched its wing curiously, wondering if it was dead. Its feelers shivered a little, but it didn't stir. I looked back at the house, at the windows, and at the door, a side door, which I had first seen through the branches. I saw, without for some while knowing that I saw, that the two carved figures by the door were living men. They stood one on each side of the door as if in readiness for someone entering from the garden or the stables. One held a staff, the other a pike, and they were both leaning right back against the wall, sound asleep. It didn't surprise me. They're asleep, I thought. It seemed natural enough here. I think I knew even then where I had come. I do not mean that I knew the story as you may know it. I didn't know why they were asleep, how it had come about that they were asleep. I didn't know the beginning of their story nor the end. I didn't know who was in the castle, but I knew already that they were all asleep. It was very strange, and I thought I should be afraid, but I couldn't feel any fear. So even then, as I stood up and went slowly down the sunny sward to the willows by the moat, I walked not as if I were in a dream, but as if I were a dream. I didn't know who was dreaming me, if not myself, but it didn't matter. I knelt in the shade of the willows and put my sore hands down into the cool water of the moat. Just beyond my reach, a golden speckled carp floated, sleeping. A water skater poised motionless on four tiny dimples in the skin of the water. Under the bridge, a swallow and her nestling slept in their mud nest. A window was open up in the castle wall. I saw a silky dark head pillowed on a pudgy arm on the window ledge. I stripped, slow and quiet in my dream movements, and slid into the water. Though I couldn't swim, I had often bathed in shallow streams in the forest. The moat was deep, but I clung to the stone coping. Presently I found a willow root that reached out from the stones where I could sit with only my head out and watch the golden speckled carp hang in the clear shadowed water. I climbed out at last, refreshed and clean. I rinsed out my sweaty winter foul shirt and trousers, scrubbing them with stones, and spread them to dry in the hot sun on the grass above the willows. I had left my coat and my thick straw-stuffed clogs up under the hedge. When my shirt and trousers were half dry, I put them on, deliciously cool and wet-smelling, and combed my hair with my fingers. Then I stood up and walked to the end of the drawbridge. I crossed it, always going slowly and quietly, without fear or hurry. The old porter sat by the great door of the castle, his chin right down on his chest. He snored long, soft snores. I pushed at the tall, iron-studded oaken door. It opened with a little groan. Two boarhounds sprawled on the flagstone door just inside, huge dogs sound asleep. One of them hunted in his sleep, scrabbling his big legs, then lay still again. The air inside the castle was still and shadowy as the air outside was still and bright. There was no sound inside or out. No bird sang, or woman, no voice spoke, or foot stirred, or bell struck the hour. The cook slept over their cauldrons in the kitchen. The maids slept at their dusting and their mending. The king and his grooms slept by the sleeping horses in the stable yard, and the queen at her embroidery frame slept among her women. The cat slept by the mouse hole and the mice between the walls. The moth slept on the woolens, and the music slept in the strings of the minstrel's harp. There were no hours. The sun slept in the blue sky, and the shadows of the willows on the water never moved. I know it was not my enchantment. I had broken, hacked, chopped, forced my way into it. I know I am a poacher. I never learned how to be anything else. Even my forest, my domain as I had thought it, was never mine. It was the king's forest, and the king slept here in his castle in the heart of his forest. But it had been a long time since anyone talked of the king. Petty barons held sway all round the forest. Woodcutters stole wood from it. Peasant boys snared rabbits in it. Stray princes rode through it now and then, perhaps hunting the red deer, not even knowing they were trespassing. I knew I trespassed, but I couldn't see the harm. I did, of course, eat their food. The venison pastry that the chief cook had just taken out of the oven smelled so delicious that hungry flesh couldn't endure it. I arranged the chief cook in a more comfortable position on the slate floor of the kitchen, with his hat crumpled up for a pillow, and then I attacked the great pie, breaking off a corner with my hands and cramming it in my mouth. It was still warm, savory, succulent. I ate my fill. Next time I came through the kitchen, the pastry was whole, unbroken. The enchantment held. Was it that as a dream I could change nothing of this deep reality of sleep? I ate as I pleased, and always the cauldron of soup was full again, and the loaves waited in the pantry, their brown crusts unbroken. The red wine brimmed the crystal goblet by the seneschal's hand, however many times I raised it, saluted him in thanks, and drank. As I explored the castle and its grounds and outbuildings, always unhurriedly, wandering from room to room, pausing often lingering over some painted scene or fantastic tapestry or piece of fine workmanship in tulle or fitting or furniture, often settling down in a soft, curtained bed or a sunny, grassy garden nook to sleep, for there was no night here, and I slept when I was tired and woke when I was refreshed. As I wandered through all the rooms and offices and cellars and halls and barns and servants' quarters, I came to know, almost as if they were furniture too, the people who slept here and there, leaning or sitting or lying down, however they had chanced to be when the enchantment stole upon them, and their eyes grew heavy, their breathing quiet, their limbs lax and still. A shepherd up on the hill had been pissing into a gopher's hole. He had settled down in a heap and slept contentedly, as no doubt the gopher was doing down in the dirt. The chief cook, as I have said, lay as if struck down, unwilling, in the heat of his art, and though I tried many times to pillow his head and arrange his limbs more comfortably, he always frowned as if to say, "Don't bother me now, I'm busy." Up at the top of the old apple orchard lay a couple of lovers, peasants like me. He, his rough trousers pulled down, lay as he had slid off her, face buried in the blossom-littered grass, drowned in sleep and satisfaction. She, a short, buxom young woman with apple-red cheeks and nipples, lay sprawled right out, skirts hiked to her waist, legs parted and arms wide, smiling in her sleep. It was again more than hungry flesh could endure. I laid myself down softly on her, kissing those red nipples, and came into her honey sweetness. She smiled in her sleep again, whenever I did so, and sometimes made a little groaning grunt of pleasure. Afterwards I would lie beside her, a partner to her friend on the other side, and drowse, and wake to see the unfalling late blossoms on the apple boughs. When I slept there inside the great hedge, I never dreamed. What had I to dream of? Surely I had all I could desire. Still, while the time passed that did not pass, used as I was to solitude, I grew lonely. The company of the sleepers grew wearisome to me. Mild and harmless as they were, and dear as many of them became to me as I lived among them, they were no better companions to me than a child's wooden toys, to which he must lend his own voice and soul. I sought work, not only to repay them for their food and beds, but because I was, after all, used to working. I polished the silver. I swept and reswept the floors where the dust lay so still. I groomed all the sleeping horses. I arranged the books on the shelves. And that led me to open a book in mere idleness and puzzle at the words in it. I hadn't had a book in my hands since that primer of my stepmother's, nor seen any other but the priest's book at the church when we went to Mass at Yule time. At first, I looked only at the pictures, which were marvelous and entertained me much. But I began to want to know what the words said about the pictures. When I came to study the shapes of the letters, they began to come back to me. A like a cat sitting, and the fat-bellied B and D, and T the carpenter's square, and so on. And A-T was at, and C-A-T was cat, and so on. And time enough to learn to read. Time enough and more than enough, slow as I might be. So I came to read. First the romances and histories in the Queen's rooms, where I first had begun to read. Then the King's library of books about wars and kingdoms and travels and famous men. And finally the Princess's books of fairy tales. So it is that I know now what a castle is, and a king, and a seneschal, and a story, and so can write my own. But I was never happy going into the tower room where the fairy tales were. I went there the first time. After the first time, I went there only for the books and the shelf beside the door. I would take a book, looking only at the shelf, and go away again at once, down the winding stair. I never looked at her but once, the first time, the one time. She was alone in her room. She sat near the window in a little straight chair. The thread she had been spinning lay across her lap and trailed to the floor. The thread was white. Her dress was white and green. The spindle lay in her open hand. It had pricked her thumb, and the point of it still stuck just above the little thumb joint. Her hands were small and delicate. She was younger even than I when I came there, hardly more than a child, and had never done any hard work at all. You could see that. She slept more sweetly than any of them, even the maid with the pudgy arm and the silky hair, even the rosy baby in the cradle in the gatekeeper's house, even the grandmother in the little south room, whom I loved best of all. I used to talk to the grandmother when I was lonely. She sat so quietly as if looking out the window, and it was easy to believe that she was listening to me and only thinking before she answered. But the princess's sleep was sweeter even than that. It was like a butterfly's sleep. I knew as soon as I entered her room that first time, that one time, as soon as I saw her, I knew that she alone in all the castle, might wake at any moment. I knew that she, alone of all of them, all of us, was dreaming. I knew that if I spoke in that tower room, she would hear me. Maybe not waken, but hear me in her sleep, and her dreams would change. I knew that if I touched her or even came close to her, I would trouble her dreams. If I so much as touched that spindle, moved it so that it did not pierce her thumb, and I longed to do that, for it was painful to see, but if I did that, if I moved the spindle, a drop of red blood would well up slowly on the delicate little cushion of flesh above the joint, and her eyes would open. Her eyes would open slowly. She would look at me, and the enchantment would be broken, the dream at an end. I have lived here within the great hedge till I am older than my father ever was. I am as old as the grandmother in the south room, gray-haired. I haven't climbed the winding stair for many years. I don't read the books of fairy tales any longer, nor visit the sweet orchard. I sit in the garden in the sunshine. When the prince comes riding and strikes his way clear through the hedge of thorns, my 2 years' toil, with one blow of his privileged bright sword, when he strides up the winding stair to the tower room, when he stoops to kiss her, and the spindle falls from her hand, and the drop of blood wells like a tiny ruby on the white skin, When she opens her eyes slowly and yawns, she will look up at him. As the castle begins to stir, the petals to fall, the little bee to move and buzz on the clover blossom, she will look up at him through the mists and tag ends of dream, 100 years of dreams, and I wonder if for a moment she will think, is that the face I dreamed of seeing? But by then I will be out by the midden heap, sleeping sounder than they ever did.